Shopping Maniacs, y'all listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave in the house with the kids. Rupert with me is Chris, comfortable in the booth choir. How's it going, Chris?
Fine. Yeah, I'd say I'm encapsulated in this.
Encapsulated. You have some black foam in there. It's creating a nice shadow. You know,
yeah, that's right.
You know, there's parts. I see parts.
Anyway, we're going to talk about web components. You know, those were like really those were open web component jokes.
Open web component jokes. How to impress your family. Step one: how to impress your family at holiday parties. Make shadow dom jokes. Families love this. They think that's funny. They don't even know what piercing the shadow dom is, but they think that's hilarious. So use that at your Christmas party. Step two, tip number two. So there was a little web component drama. I went on a trip into the mountains and didn't have the internet. Yeah. But there's a little web component drama that broke out. I don't even know what it was. I think like somebody used one and that caused a big old stinko.
I actually don't even know what you're talking about. I have some things to discuss about web components, but I missed this drama.
I just saw like Zach Leatherman getting into it. I think he's using it now in some places or something. Anyway.
Isn't it funny how those are the big stories? They're like, GitHub used one once.
Who that? What? Oh my gosh.
For some kind of menu component or something. Or they also used to use it for like a time component of some kind. That is interesting. I mean, of course it's interesting when web technology that isn't everywhere else in the world does get rolled out on big sites. I do find that kind of newsworthy sometimes. But
if somebody used Svelte in a big way, I would be like, ooh, that's interesting.
It is. It's always interesting. Yeah. And, you know, this whole show won't be about web components, by the way, if you just don't care about that. But it is an interesting set of technologies that's still kind of hotly talked about and interesting. And there's releases all the time in this world. You know, big companies are still thinking this is the way. So I just happened to notice a couple of web components articles. And the way that I save news, you know, I use that Notion web clipper. You just click it, and then sometimes I'll tag the post too. So and then if there's a bunch of links that are all kind of have the same tag, I'm like, what can I like combine about these articles? You know, like what's happening right now that a lot of people are talking about this thing. And so
That's a roundup.
You just round up
the link. Yeah.
Yeah, and hopefully with some, you know, the point of doing this is like commentary around it. But one of them I saw was called Shoelace, which looks brand new, and it's a pattern library like Bootstrap or whatever. But the thing is in web components. It's not the first of its kind, but it's a recent release in it, and I do think that pattern libraries are the best possible use case for web components. They're the coolest thing you can do with web components, I think, because they're, it seems to be built for that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's distributable. Like, that's the one thing web components want to be.
Right.
Like, open web tech, you're not tied to a framework. Like, just these little chunks of code.
And are you tied to a framework? That's kind of the question, you know? You can, like, there's, for example, there's this technology called Stencil. Stencil's from the Ionic people, and they've been going heavy on this. So Ionic is also like a pattern library that ships with web components. But it used to just be for one thing. Wasn't it like, didn't it start with Angular or something? I don't know.
It was Angular to begin with, and then I think they went web component, like Stencil. And now they like offer React and React Native
and Vue stuff
now and Vue.
So that's super cool, I think. Like you can make these native web component library, and then the bindings for your other frameworks are just pick and choose. You know, oh, you want this other system? I think that's notable and interesting. So there's that. And then so this Shoelace library that I just mentioned is also built on Stencil. So you got kind of like there's some like connections to these things, but Stencil isn't the only one on you know, Google's hot on Lit Element in the Lit world, you know, and Microsoft has this thing called Fast.
I didn't know about Fast.
Asta's their kind of version of lit, I think. Although, you know, I should say that I'm just kind of like learning and watching about this stuff. What I don't have is absolute expert level stuff. I'm not shipping major production products in this. So my opinions are a bit tempered by that. As somebody who's kind of watching and is interested in this and, you know, has the perspective of whatever, a couple of decades now of building websites. So there's that. But the thing, so I talk about in this article, hey, there's Stencil, there's Shoelace, there's Fast, and Fast is not only a framework, but it has a pattern library thing that you can use too. There are people like vying for your attention for their network of stuff to use here. And I didn't, you know, didn't super directly draw the thing like this is the same as React and Vue fighting for your attention. It's a little different than that. Notably because of something like Stencil, where you can write the framework and still use either framework. But, you know, historically, part of this has been like, you know, React doesn't actually work that well with web components, right? There's like a lot of friction there. But anyway, we'll ignore that for a moment. These things are built on a build chain of stuff. If you choose to use Stencil to build your things, that's a great, cool, good choice. No problem there. But you are there is a build step involved. You are buying into some technology if you build your stuff there. It is not absolutely nothing that you're buying into. And some of the comments were like, you don't have to, though. If you want to put some Ionic tabs and some Fast tabs and some Shoelace tabs all on the same page, you can totally do that. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I guess you can, but like you can also load MooTools and jQuery on the same page, you know? Like,
yeah. Yeah, there's a footprint. You know, I ran into this with my, I have this thing called Awesome Standalones. It's like a list of web components that stand alone, like kind of cool things you can just drop into your project, like a carousel or something like that. But you're like no framework dependent, you know, like nothing like that. But my thing was like, I want like pure web components, like no frameworks. You know, if I see like it imports a framework, then I don't want to include it in here. But then I had to flex on that because a lot of web components use something like lit or something like that to, or sure. Stencil too. But yeah, then like if you have lit in your page and Stencil on your page and whatever, some other thing.
And there, like, it's hard to compare them exactly because they are like 2K each or like lit is like super tiny, right? So it's not quite the same.
It's not like two Reacts or something, React and Vue or something like that.
But it's not you ship to the client, but it's also your build chain. Like you can't have three build chain. Like you're buying into technology on two levels there. It's not just what happens in the browser. It's what happens in the build process too.
Because if one's like written in TypeScript and one's not, like what do you do, you know? Like, does that impact you? I don't know, but
can I finish? The ending thing was me just kind of being like, isn't this a little weird? Is that that I can open CodePen and write a web component? I can just write one. It's not that hard, you know. I've done it many times, you know. And that it's curious to me that everybody buys into some kind of additional thing too. And this is where my ignorance shows a little bit. Like I guess I kind of get why, but not entirely. Like it seems like absolutely everybody picks something. They pick lit or hyper HTML or some kind of thing because they say that the dev experience just isn't quite there if you're just using raw web components. And I thought, like, why is nobody doing it though? Like, is it absolutely required to use a kind of build step for your web components, even though it's a native web technology? And the answer, this is where I got called out the most for the article, is that web components weren't really designed to be used raw. They were designed as low-level primitives in which for frameworks to be built on top of. That was the idea from the beginning. And I guess I just didn't really realize that. Mm-hmm. That you're like kind of like not almost not supposed to use them raw. And I was like, really? Okay.
That, in my opinion, is maybe the biggest flaw of web components and like mismarketing or whatever. You know, it's that it was maybe too low level and normies like me and you can't use it, you know, or shouldn't be using it. And like, why would you build something in the web platform that normies aren't supposed to use? That's weird. But again, I think like, I don't know. I think people would use them more if they had some nice sugar, you know, like I think WordPress would use it if it had some nice sugar, you know, and that's what these libraries like Lit and things add. And then I love the pre-builtness, you know, but yeah, it's like, I know ING, the bank has like some components, you know, like, and somebody was like, oh, you should put, you know, you can use ING button on there or whatever, Lion button on your website. And like, it's a standalone. And I just was like, but I'm not going to use like Lion's design system. Like the coupling to a design system too is kind of weird. Like it's not, you're not just importing a button, you're importing a whole design system. And so that comes with CSS and stuff. You know, like I just, there's, yeah. I don't know that, I think we're ahead, like, the distribution is easy now with NPM or whatever. Like we're ahead of the distribution sort of like, but I don't know that we've like figured out like how to, I don't know, cohesively author web components. Does that?
Yeah.
I don't.
Isn't this, that's why it leaves us dumbfounded. And like, whatever happens, however we got here, the fact that we can't have a conversation that's just without just like hanging our heads and being like, I don't know. That's the failure. There's no good story. There's no good way to talk about this stuff. That's just like, yeah, do that. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, I think for me, it comes in, like, I think there's like a gateway to like using web components. I use this one from Google called 2Up a lot. And it's one of those like before after photo slider things, you know?
Yeah. I love that one.
I don't want to code that.
That's a great
one. Dave Rupert does not want to code that. Like, I don't want to spend a Saturday figuring that out for a dumb blog post. But like, I will punch that into a blog post, no problem. And all it does, it just takes two images and it'll handle all the sliding for me. Uh-huh. That's awesome.
I know.
I love that.
You know, I'm not using that specifically, but the block editor in WordPress. If you get a bunch of bonus components if you use Jetpack, and they just, you know, this is like totally unrelated to the, it's related to the conversation that they have a 2Up slider, and just because it's there and it works so easily and flawlessly, I just use it. You know, I love it when technology is just like, here you go, it's easy to use. Probably internally they should use this web component. I doubt that they do. But that's the kind of, it's just such a tremendous use case for it, especially because it doesn't really need much UI. So you're not really buying into a design system there. Like, right. It's just a bar and you slide it.
Bar and some arrows. You could add whatever to the bar. Yeah. So that's it too, is I don't even, like you said, the web component story, right? Which is like, I don't know. Are we startups? We're startups. So we talk about stories, man, the story, tell the story. Like the web component story, you know, it was like piercing the shadow DOM and styling your own components and things like that. Like that was kind of difficult and confusing until like very recently with Part and stuff like that, which is, that's still confusing and something you have to learn. I wonder too, if that's like a part of the missing part of the story is how easily it is to style and change and update web components, or I import a web component, am I just stuck with it or what? You know, I think that's, you know, some of the thing, right?
Yeah, like, we didn't even get into the styling story, which is all I find tremendously confusing.
Yeah. So, I mean,
which leads to the point where if I was going to kick off a new product and it felt like a product that I should definitely be building in components, which I got to say, I'm on that train. I think that's most projects these days. Like front end development is shaken out where the component model is kind of the right model, regardless of what you're building. You don't always need a reactive component model. You don't always need everything that the frameworks offer, but even just building a blog, I think the right primitive is the component. But anyway, if I was kicking off a new product of kind of any scope, but let's say it's something like CodePen, you know, the thing that I have experience with, would I pick web components? Almost definitely not. I would pick something with a much more robust developer model. And that's still Vue. And React to me, I'd probably pick one or the other.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I would pick Vue. I mean, I have a project in Vue, even though I like web components. It probably doesn't need to be Vue, to be honest. Like the more I work with it, I'm like, man, kind of really over-engineered this one. but like, you know, I just knew I was like hitting data sources and stuff. And so I just was like, you know, I should just use Vue, you know? But man, I'm just not 100% in, even though I'm like Mr. Pro Web Tech anti-framework or whatever, not really, but like, even though that's like sort of in my ethos, like why am I not like all in on these? It's hard. It's just not quite there yet. And I'd love to figure out what
but
it is.
But it does have the feather in its cap to me is that it has the Shadow DOM. It has something that a framework can't do. The Shadow DOM is totally unique to the web platform and very powerful mm-hmm. concept. So the thing that's going to blow this thing out of the park is if a major framework brings along all of its power and decides to go in on web components. If Vue 4 was web components, that's going to change the game, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, that would be interesting to see. I don't know. I would love to explore it more, but again, it's like time and I'm not going to make that gamble on my clients and websites and stuff. Like that's hard. Right. But I'd like to go that route. There's so much potential there, but
yeah. All right. That's my thing. And, you know, grain of salt, all that, cause I don't have nearly the experience that a lot of people do, let alone, you know, the CEO of Ionic or whatever, you know, I'm sure you know what you're doing over there. So please continue doing what you're doing.
Well, it is interesting. They had to kind of like tailor, like they were like, you know what? A lot of people are using React. We just have to, we'll have to ship a React version of it, you know, we have customers that want that. And so we'll have to use that. So, and that web components didn't just work, just work in big quotes.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Notion. Oh, I love Notion. We talk about it regularly on this show, I feel like. And this is their first sponsorship, so high five about that. Real quick at the top, notion.com/shoptalk gets you 10% off a team plan, so know that. The URL is notion.so, but notion.com, that's all you got to remember. Don't worry about the domain. notion.com/shoptalk will get you there. So what Notion has done for me, you know, I could talk forever about this, but is replaced and consolidated a bunch of other apps. And that wasn't even what I set out to do. It just has happened that way. And I love that it did. So for example, my to-do lists, they're all in Notion now because the Notion document structure is perfect for that kind of thing. Documents of any kind, that's the thrust of Notion, that are nested within each other, that can be of different kinds. And it's all beautifully designed and customizable. Like I had a publication calendar. I'd keep it in a spreadsheet because that was kind of like the closest thing I could figure out to organizing it. Now that is a database in Notion where I have all these different views of it, like calendar view and list view. And it's just a wonderful place to do a publication calendar, huge upgrade. And I can share it with my team and share parts of it with access with other people. It's just great for a publication calendar. So I'm so happy to have that. But, you know, we'd have like a wiki at CodePen in our Git repos that would explain like internal coding guidelines and these things you need to know about CodePen and working there. That kind of wiki like stuff is perfect. Get rid of that. Get it over in Notion. It's a lot more findable, a lot more nice to look at, a lot more organized. Love it. Meeting notes, I never really got a good system for it. Like I'd keep text files in a Dropbox folder. No way. All my notes now, whether they're personal or shared or whatever, I do it all in Notion. The biggest thing I use for it now is planning. So like our active projects on everything. And I use this at CodePen, CSS Tricks, Shop Talk Show here. We all have different workspaces. We all do it all in Notion. Planning projects is so great there. You can do it however you want, but ultimately projects for me turn into these Kanban boards of tasks that get assigned to people that have information in them, comment threads, all that. Project planning is wonderfully done in Notion. So notion.com/shoptalk, get yourself 10% off if we got you convinced.
You know, back in the day, we're old enough, maybe not all the listeners here are old enough to remember, but you know, there was MooTools, Prototype, Dojo, jQuery, YUI, stuff like there was a half dozen different JavaScript frameworks, and you would just write your JavaScript in that framework. And there are different plugins, you know, there's, you know, different ways to animate, different plugins, different everything. And eventually, just the great, you know, sifting of the internet, jQuery kind of sprung ahead. And I don't know why and don't remember any the reason exactly, but jQuery kind of sprung ahead.
Mook tools like classes. Nobody liked classes at the time. That was too weird.
Yeah. Well, and it just, but I'm curious, like, too, like, I think everyone is like, I know, I'll write my own web component library, you know, like, and it's like, no, like the whole point of web components is like, we should use the great mind of hive mind of the web and not repeat ourselves, you know? So like, is there a, is not that we need more kings and more, you know, kind of rock star frameworks or whatever, but like, is there one big standout, like, web component framework we should probably all get behind and say we're starting our projects here? Is that, does that exist? OpenWC, Open Web Components, seems like a thing. But, you know, is there one we could all kind of put weight behind and hit a critical mass to where web components become a thing?
Is there a secret conspiracy to this? Isn't that why Microsoft put effort behind FAST? I mean, don't you think that's deep in there? Why does Google care about Lit? They care because they want to like control a little chunk of the ecosystem. You know, that there's just benefit to that. I don't know. I don't know why low down. I mean,
that's interesting. My thought would be like Google made Polymer, and Polymer was supposed to be the racehorse. You know, That was supposed to be the thing. But then there's a lot of kickback and pushback against Polymer. But then I think even internally, Polymer had some trouble getting adopted, you know, like there were some like things on YouTube or something. I don't know. So I wonder if I wonder if Lit exists to support X Polymer customers, you know, like it's an internal project that they also make external. I wonder, but, because AMP is also a web component framework, or was, you know, or is, I guess, but, you know.
Yeah, you got to wonder what the, like, the hardcore, like, the strategy way above the, like, kind of the average developers that work on these things probably are privy to, like, you know, high-level manager product owners at these companies. What do they talk about? Why are they like, okay, we're going to, you know, put $15 million in this budget bucket for this technology. Why does that get okayed? Why did that become a good idea at all? I am totally ignorant to that. Is it because they're like, well, if we control the tool chain for this, that, you know, then our internal products are built from it and we get some like developer notoriety and it's easier to hire? Is it a hiring thing? Is it a...
I think for React, that's true. I think you control developers' minds. That's part, like...
The story there was kind of like, we need the technology in order to build our product because our product will be better if we build the perfect tool for it. Is that still the case? I don't know.
I think there's power in like corporate power, not like we're all like minions or orcs from Lord of the Rings or something, but there's corporate power in having developer mindshare, you know, like,
yeah, maybe that's it. It's as kind of vague as that, but that's what I mean. Like, once you have the mindshare, in what way do you then benefit? You know, like, mindshare isn't the final goal. The final goal is whatever mindshare buys you.
Well, I mean, you look at, here's Windows versus Mac, you know, like in the early 2000s, they sucked up a lot of, like, Windows was where all the software was. Mac had bad software or whatever. And then, like, slowly with Rails and different things, like, developer mindshare started shifting over, and cool hardware, developer mindshare started shifting over the Mac. And now the Mac has all the cool hardware, like, software, and Windows is kind of like, oops, like, like, this hasn't been updated in a few decades, you know? So, like, I think developer mindshare builds your ecosystem, it builds your tools, it builds, you know, it all boats floats things. And that's the same with React. I mean, you get the best extensions, you get the best plugins, you get the best state managers because you have Mindshare. And so your, you know, your React framework just grows and grows and grows. So
this is fascinating stuff to think about. I think, what's the real reason for it all? We got deep there quick. Let's stay in this world for a minute, though. We have one from Jake McKelvey here who says, I'm about to build a new single-page website for a client who started a nonprofit. Pretty basic. What they want is basically static. They're not even making the changes themselves. They're going to come to me, meaning Jake, for the updates. It's just some basic copy, images, a donate button that goes, just shoots you over to PayPal. You know, Jake says, I've been making websites for a better part of a decade, but I still don't have a tremendous grasp on the newfangled frameworks and understanding of when or why I would benefit from using them, and understand that it's still okay, you know, to just use HTML, CSS, and JS. You know, if it works, it works. Just build websites, etc. Can you help me understand whether I would actually stand to benefit from using one framework or another for something like this? Is there a framework that is meant to for this kind of thing? My inclination is just to build it, keep it simple, so I'm not upgrading dependencies all the time, and yada, yada. So, Jake, you're building it literally a one-page site with a donate button where they're very happy to just shoot people over to PayPal. I mean, I can't picture every aspect of this site, but that seems like the easiest one in the world for me to feel confident to say that you do not need a framework of any kind for this website.
Yeah, I would say don't. And if you're super happy with what you do, like, do that. I think this is my philosophy. I think where frameworks come in handy, and this could even be like some kind of CSS grid framework. This could be some CSS utility library framework. This could be a JavaScript framework. If you find yourself doing repetitive tasks, that's where frameworks can benefit you, whether that's on a page-by-page basis or a client-by-client basis. In the early days of Paravel, I put my foot down and I said, every site is 960 grid because I'm not going to come up with a new whole new layout system for every single site we're building. And like that was maybe like heavy-handed of me, like for Reagan and Trent. But I just was like, we have to have some structure I can like build with. I can't just continue. I can't just one-off every single page of this website. I need a consistent baseline. So that was how we made our money in the early days. You know, we just said, we're going to use 960 grid. You know, then, you know, some responsive frameworks came out and we kind of tried to roll our own grids here and there. But that was after we kind of understood how grids kind of worked in a design. So that helped us. Same with the JavaScript framework. Like I think I just said, if I'm like doing a lot of data fetching and a lot of template generating and stuff like that, I've done that in jQuery plenty of times. It's not fun. Like if you have like 10 buttons and 10 templates that you're generating and spitting out, I would rather use a framework for that. So that's where if there's a high repetition, I think a framework starts to pay off.
Yeah, my mind went right to the JavaScript framework thing. You know, I still think this is, I wrote this in 2017, but because it was definitely a journey I had to take too. There was kind of a long time where frameworks like React were a thing and I just didn't get it. I just didn't understand what you would need that for. You know, even while CodePen existed and we were building it and the whole thing was Rails and jQuery and, you know, React was there, but I'm just like, I don't know. And it was CodePen in which that I first used React after kind of, launching some investigation, learning more about it, doing some prototypes, having other developers on my team kind of advocate that that would be the right approach. And then we bought into it and now slowly have moved to, you know, and to this day, we're still not 100% across the board converted, because conversion is quite a process, although we're mostly there and etc. So, you know, I think just shortly after that, me kind of getting it, April 20th, 2017, I finally wrote this article that says, when does a project need React? And it was like my take on that kind of moment, which I think you're looking for, Jake, where it's kind of like maybe just raw HTML, CSS, and JavaScript aren't enough anymore. Like when's the tipping point where you kind of need to reach for it? Dave articulated one very nicely is templating. if you need that, if it's that moment where you need, clearly you need client-side generated templates, your server isn't handling it, your server's giving you the data, but you need to kind of smoosh those into templates client-side, that can be good for that. Although that story is complicated these days by being able to do some of that on the server, but let's not go there yet. And my first one in the article was about state. And now, to me, state couldn't be more clear as a concept, but I feel like there's plenty of developers out there that are just like, I build lots of websites and I never even think about the word state. State's just not in my brain. It's just not important to the type of websites I build. And there's probably a lot of developers out there that that's all I do all day long. I live and think in state. It's kind of an interesting dividing moment, you know? There's like developers who live in state and ones that just could, it doesn't matter. And it's almost the difference, and I hate to ever say this, but it's, sites versus apps. You know, like, I don't like that distinction, don't get me wrong, but I think there's mostly gray in the middle, but on the edges, at least conceptually, you can kind of understand it. Like, it's a site with a dashboard on it that's showing, you know, that you log into and you have paid plans and the dashboard shows stock data on it is clearly what people think of when they think of app. There's lots of data flying around there. There's, you know, dashboard widgets that you're dragging around and you're, you know, I don't know, changing your password and you're just doing all this like app-like stuff. And then there's sites that are just like, it's a blog. You publish blog posts. The blog post has a URL. That's it. You know, on the far other side, I think people understand that. And on the app side, that's where state, there's just way more state happening. You're like, which widgets are active? Which widgets have what data? Which widget is collapsed or not collapsed? Which widget, you know, I don't know. Yeah. There's just all this state stuff. And JavaScript frameworks handle state elegantly. It's kind of like their top feature, perhaps.
Yeah, the reactivity, especially. So if that state changes, that change will cascade down through the whole page and update your whole page based on one little data change.
Yeah. Then there's this idea like you're working on a site and there's that whole chunk of gray area in between I talked about. You have this site, but it's like, oh, now it's got a commenting system. And honestly, you know what? It kind of Ajaxes in some other blog posts from other areas of the site sometimes. And yeah, you grow and grow and grow and you're writing more and more JavaScript that goes with it. Imagine that was jQuery in the back in the day, but maybe Jake, you're just writing vanilla JavaScript now and adding it. And it starts to get to be a lot. It starts to get to be the point where you're like concatenating files together. You're like different pages have different JavaScript files on them because you don't want to load it all everywhere because it's too much. You get to this point where you're like, you're writing a lot of JavaScript and it's totally separated from the HTML. There's this also this concept that if you go into a framework, those two things start to get smashed together. Your JavaScript and your HTML start to live side by side in a way that they don't when you're just writing raw HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. Which gets to this point where it's kind of called spaghetti, that it feels so separated. To reason about how the JavaScript is doing what it's doing on the page, you got to like, you're looking at the HTML and seeing what's there. And then totally separately, somewhere else in your code base, there's some JavaScript that touches the DOM and figures some stuff out there. It starts to get hard to reason about and it starts to have bugs because you're like, oh, somebody changed the selector in the HTML and it totally broke this component somewhere else in the app because the DOM selector is now wrong. You just get this spaghetti problem and this bug problem. And that's another moment where JavaScript frameworks stepped in and said, if we smash all this stuff together, we're solving a lot of problems here. We're solving the bugs. We're solving the difficulty to reason about what's happening on any given component. And component is a big word there too. That's very helpful. It brings that component model that I think a lot of front-end developers are like, yep, that's a nice way to build. Okay, that's my rant.
Yeah, I was going to say too, like the convention aspect like is a thing too. When I build a website by myself, I just put files wherever and it's not helpful to anyone who shows up later. But hopefully the framework you go with might have some conventions. Oh, we put components files in a folder called components, or we put pages in a folder called pages. You know, not every framework has that. Like React doesn't really enforce anything like that. but like Vue kind of does, but Nuxt, which is another layer on top of Vue, certainly does. And so, you know, there's stuff like that. Like
developers might, like conventions, or if you think you don't, you probably will be convinced later that you do. You
know? Imagine hopping into a project that you've never worked on, you know, and you know exactly what's going on. That's a huge deal.
Yeah.
Dave Rupert can hop into any Rails project on the planet and be like, I kind of get what's going on. Totally. You know, absolutely. Like I don't have to like think like, oh man, where's the database config? It's like, you know, it's in the db.rb file. Yeah. You know? Like it's always in there. And so like that's the power of frameworks in theory, you know, or React. It's like all these components, they all work the same. Like, whereas with like a jQuery component, which you can have those, they don't, component A and component B are going to be radically different. They're just going to be like, who knows? The classes can be all different. The what you change, how you show, how you hide, all that stuff can be all different. Like a framework, there's going to be some consistency, hopefully. So that's when I would, if you're having consistency problems, that's when a framework helps.
I love it. That was a nice little segment. I should sell that MP3 for $1. Enjoy it.
$1. Why to use a framework .mp3.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by WordPress.com. You might know WordPress.com is like the hosted version of WordPress, so you need nothing at all. You want to spin up a site, you go to WordPress.com, you spin up a site, it could be for anything. It could be an e-commerce site, could be a landing page site for your business, could be a portfolio site, could be a photography-based site, could be a blog, of course. I love all those ideas. Please have a site for the things that you do, including a personal website and those for your businesses. That would make me happy. And it'll be a site that you don't have to worry about because it's totally handled by them, right? There's no performance concerns or like getting hacked concerns or all that. So I really like it when people choose WordPress.com for sites with like zero technical debt. You know, like let them handle the stuff. But this is something that I don't think a lot of people know. It's a relatively new thing, is that you can have, and you got to be on like the business or e-commerce plan to have this. You can have SFTP access to the site, and you have database access as well. So it's really similar to any other host, right? You sign up for a hosting plan and they're like, here's your welcome email with your SFTP credentials. This is how you SFTP in and, you know, put the files here. And that's how you operate a website, you know. And a lot of us these days, I know, at least this is how I do it, have some kind of deployment system set up that has access to those SFTP credentials. So then I'm working locally, I'm working in Git, I'm committing to branches and all that. And the deployment software is like, oh, somebody pushed something to master. I'm going to go ahead and deploy that to the live site. That's how I do things. I think that's a nice kind of DevOps setup that even somebody like me can do without like extreme DevOps knowledge. There's no reason those SFTP credentials couldn't be to your WordPress.com plan. So you're just using it like a WordPress host, which I think is really neat. You know, it's like you can still have this modern developer workflow, be working locally on your WordPress site and then shipping it up to WordPress.com. You can have your own plugins, your own theme, you can mess with the functions.php file, you know, just like it's still just your totally custom WordPress site. It's just hosted on WordPress.com. It's kind of a mind shift because I don't think people think of WordPress.com in that way. And that's because it's new and you can do it now. So try it out.
All right, James writes in. I have to read these because sometimes people say, don't say my name. So, yeah. Okay. James, I believe, or we'll call him Johnny. So what are we supposed to do to make phone numbers and zip codes or numbers in general more accessible? For context, I've been trying to do more for accessibility, labeling forms, being mindful of contrast, alt text, all that good stuff. I was on a site using what I presume to be a plugin called AudioEye. That's we should have like nefarious music that's come up before. That offers some accessibility tools right in the browser. Contrast, font changes, reading guideline, screen reader stuff, etc. So I started playing around with it and got to a zip code and then a phone number in the screen reader. Well, Didn't do what I hoped or expected. It read the zip code as 62,704. And on the telephone number, Ahref Tel, whatever the telephone number, it read a bunch of attributes that I assume were used by the plugin.
That's a good point. The phone number. I know.
And it read 217, which is the first like three digits of the phone number for the area code. And the rest of the numbers were read as individual digits.
Which is kind
of
what you want.
Four, that five, good. Six, seven, eight. Yeah, kind of weird. I guess because you had parentheses around it, maybe it was grouping that. But
yeah, that's good though. Like you wouldn't want. The zip code is definitely bad. Like if your zip code is 12345, it should read 12345, not 12,345. That's just not how people say zip codes, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. How do you force that to work? Do you know a trick to get it to read right?
Well, so that one was probably input type equals number, which is not what you want to use for a zip code for a few reasons, like the number input has that little scroller. So if you like accidentally mouse wheel, and you could picture somebody who has like limited mobility or something like that, is trying to click on their, you know, web page, and accidentally hits the scroll wheel and scrolls their zip code up 1,000 numbers. Like that's bad, you know, like, so number inputs are kind of poorly designed in that way. So you should probably just use a text input, but there's this new API, I guess, called input mode, which is an attribute.
Right.
And there's like 1,000 different options for input mode.
Yeah, there really are, but they're all cool. That is worth checking out. They're kind of just like, it's the first API that's like, just tell me what kind of input you want for this input. Like, do you want it to be the one that's really good for zip codes? Well, then just tell me and I'll make sure that I give you the keyboard that's good for zip codes rather than guess because of some pattern attribute or something. You don't have to guess anymore. You just tell it what keyboard you want, essentially. It's pretty sweet.
Yeah, and that's what I would recommend, the input mode. The support's pretty broad. You can also use the pattern like as numbers, and Mobile Safari will be like, oh, that's a number input or a number inputter. But you also have to remember, for like a zip code, only US is digits only, you know? Mm-hmm. Other countries have non-digits in, you know, they have alphanumeric characters in their zip code.
Yeah.
Some countries have dashes. You know, America technically has an 11-digit zip code system with a dash, you know, in the middle.
That stuff alone is something like, I'm just going to use some third-party thing where it's their problem, not mine. Wouldn't it be cool
if you had a web component called zip code or whatever, input?
Yeah, right. As long as it had like 5,000 plus stars on GitHub. That's the only way I would trust it.
10,000 stars, social validation. I paid a foreign
for real, but more like I just want to use like the Stripe thing. That's just like, oh, I don't even want to be responsible for that input. Somebody else do it. But there's not only inputs here though, but I think he's talking about just like the numbers, just like in the HTML, just like Dave, like a paragraph tag that says Dave Rupert's zip code is 1234. How do you get that to read right?
You know, I think you'd just have to like, you know, I don't know that there's a really good way. I think you kind of like screen reader users will be either be accustomed to it in a certain way. It sounds weird to us, the non-screen reader users, but they may just be accustomed to it. Yeah. I mean, even capital ZIP for zip code, the screen reader might read like, how do you make phone numbers and ZIP codes, you know, like.
Yeah, and you just have heard it like, 10,000 times. You're like, I don't care. I get what they're saying.
So you're just used to it, you know. But again, it's, you know, and maybe that's even better than just hearing a series of random numbers, like 6, 7, 2, 5, 3, 4. You know, you're just like, dude, what happened? But like 62,374. I'm like, okay, now I can group those mentally in my brain. Like now I know. It was only a 5-digit number, So
credit to James here. He says, maybe I'm making assumptions about how different people interpret numbers, but I know I'd be hella confused if somebody gave me their zip code as 62,000, blah, 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 blah. I think that's so. Yeah. So you're saying you'd be confused, but you are not the person that this is for. Like, you know, both mm-hmm. Dave and you are making a very strong point here in that you just don't know unless you ask or test.
Yeah. And there's also like other, like bailouts, like you can, like there's a key command to where you can read every individual character. So if you heard like the zip code is 2,974 or whatever, you could be like, oh shoot, let me go character by character, 78937. Okay, mm-hmm. that's like next door. I get that. Like, so there's like other tools for people, you know? Okay. And again, like accessible text is not just screen readers, like if somebody's using a Braille reader, they'll just feel numbers, you know, like don't over-focus on the announcing, but it's important. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you don't put commas in it, that's a big thing. I don't know how you'd like trick the screen reader. And I don't think it's like worth it to optimize the speech of the screen reader. But if you find a good way to, then I think you should use it. But I think like a lot of the, I think what you'll probably end up doing is making a hack that'll have like negative ramifications later. You know, you kind of just need to supply the best HTML possible. And that's using the right elements. That's using everything. And then like the best elements possible and let the screen reader do the best job it can. So like, don't try to trick the screen reader. That's what I would say. Hopefully that helps. Probably a bad answer. You can talk to accessibility experts over at theaccessibilityproject.com.
There you go. So,
A11yproject.com.
We have one here from a maybe Swedish person, and they wrote in their pronunciation notes for their name. It says, pronunciation impossible.
I'm going to give it to you, Chris, to take a step.
Well, they guessed that we would pronounce it Sjerpfenwooden, okay. Which is fine. But that's what they said we'd say. So the actual name is Sjerpfenwooden.
Sjerpfenwooden. Nice to meet you, Sjerp.
I've been a no build tools, no frameworks dev for 5 years now, and he likes our kind of our stuff sometimes when we talk about, you know, good old CSS and Dave's no build tools rants and the like, which, you know, be like, we do that.
Welcome
sometimes.
To the curmudgeon club. Hey.
I like to think we're fair and balanced. Anyway. Ugh, I shouldn't have said that. Yet the fields demand I move to frameworks. And hey, let's assume I'm wrong and everybody else is right. I don't want to be, that's a weird statement, a flesh-made IE? What does that mean? You throw around the concept of op state a lot, but it's unclear to me what you mean by it. I'm sure I've had my share of state. Oh, this is funny. We just talked about state, isn't it? I'd use body tags class and other attributes as a global repository for letting the rest of the app know through the cascade what is going on. So I presume I'm missing out on understanding big win for frameworks by not understanding what you mean by state. So let's not dwell on this, but I do think that it's an interesting concept of just using the body element and just slapping tags all over it to indicate state. Well, that's possible. You could say on a body tag class, you know, widget 342 hidden. And then that will cascade to wherever it needs to be in the DOM. So you could say body.widget2424hidden.widget display none or something. I mean, sure, you could hide your widget that way, but that's not like it's still sitting there in the DOM. Then it's just like, that's not how kind of modern apps do it. They, you know, the state, whether a widget should be visible or not, is probably handled somewhere else in a way such that you don't even have to render it in the DOM if it's not there, that kind of thing.
You know, I had a client, you know, when we started building their site, they're like, oh, you know, customers can be in three states, cold, warm, or hot. And I was like, oh, okay. Cold, warm, hot. Cold is like not, you know, brand new, very new to the site. Warm is like they've engaged with the site, and hot is like they've purchased something, you know? Mm. And we were like, okay, cool. That's great, you know? And then it was like, we can manage that level of state. We were like, okay, yeah, we can do that with a data attribute. And we'll like show hide things based on their state, and that'll be great. It was working. And then, but slowly, like more state came in. Like, oh, do they have an account or no account? Oh, okay. So if they've logged in, then yeah, they have an account. So there's logged in, logged out state. And so now we have like, oh, another set state. And then there's another one. And, you know, it's just like,
yeah.
Oh, do they have items in the cart right now state? You know, and like, so that it started building and building and building. And so the little like tricks we were doing to manage state and like even in just the design system kind of started falling apart. And like, it's worth actually like, probably we need like a more, you know, ideally like a JavaScript object that says the state of all these things.
There you go. Right. You need a, what they call a source of truth. So if your app needs to know a particular state, if your answer to that is, well, then I go, you know, document.querySelectorBody.ClassList.contains some state or something, you're asking the DOM what the current state of the app is, that's a big red flag. The DOM probably should never be the source of truth for state for your app. Like Dave said, it's probably at a minimum some kind of JavaScript object, if not some even more robust concept of state in your app. And sometimes it's nice if there's like really like ceremonious ways to change that state. That's not as simple as just changing some attribute, that you're really being emphatic about how you're changing that piece of state. And maybe, you know, and again, that's something a framework might help you with, but it also might do the other side of that job. A lot of times they call this pub sub, there's other words for it, but if you change that state, wouldn't it be nice to then tell everybody else who cares about that piece of state that that state has changed? jQuery's not going to help you with that, you know?
Yeah, it's a lot of like listening and broadcasting events and stuff, and that's kind of how React works under the hood. I mean, you could do totally do that. And actually CSS is a pretty good state manager. Like it's a state machine. It's like dot blue, turn it blue, you know, like it's kind of a state machine under the hood.
Vue's even better because they have a blessed state, global state tool, you know?
Yeah. I just, in my experience, like adding state to the body, like it works, but then as the concerns start to grow, it got like, I need something to manage this. Like, and that's where a framework kind of helps. So again,
There might even be race conditions and stuff when you start messing around with that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's, you know, if like a product configurer or whatever, you know, like that can get pretty tough. Like, you know, so you have to like, that's a lot of state in there, you know, and, you know, maybe if you're like a certain whatever Patreon level donor, you get new customizable whatever character features or whatever, and you're at, you're like, that's a lot of stuff. So, all right, should we go to the next question? That can be
the last one here, I think.
All right, last question. You talked a lot about, this is still Sierp. You've talked a lot about SVGs, and you stated that modern design tools are better than Adobe products at generating clean SVG code. My colleagues use Adobe. Then for our last app, I put SVGs and they only partially rendered when I added more SVGs. I look at the code and it was verbose. That got me thinking about the cause besides the point, just code the SVGs. Here's my hypotheses. Aren't SVGs a trade-off? Initially, you send a little code over the wire, but the browser has computations to do where the example of a raster image is large over the wire, but easy to render. What do you know about SVG memory consumption versus, you know, PNG or JPG?
It's less. I think you're just wrong about that. Yes, it has computation to do, but there's more computation to do with a pixel image. It's got a it's an equal amount of work or more, depend to a raster image. And I don't have any data to point you to, but that's whenever you think about memory usage, people are always pointing at raster images and showing how intense the memory usage is there. And I don't really hear that talked about with SVG so much. Now, there are limits to everything. If there's 2 billion points in your SVG file, the browser is going to chug on that. But it's like, there's limits. There's this, again, like there's a balance of everything. And you'll know because the SVG file will be 4 megabytes or something. Like, that's not acceptable for a raster or SVG. So there you go. You started talking about tools a little bit. I think there is big differences in what the tools output for SVG. But you should never use what just comes out of the tool anyway. Like, I maybe someday that will change in the land of tooling, and tooling will kind of compete on the quality of their output. And there is stuff, you know, Sketch has a plugin that will optimize your SVGs before it comes out and all that. I still, whatever, just make it part of your build process so that if other people use different tools, it's okay. I think no matter what tool, like literal like design software people use to make the SVGs or hand coding it or whatever else, it should go through an SVG optimizing process so that you're just kind of guaranteed that the SVG is like as good as it can be before it actually goes to out to production.
Yeah, I used, so my colleagues use Adobe. What I do is I go into Adobe, I select the thing, the vector in Illustrator, I copy it and I paste it into SVG OMG Jake Archibald's tool. And that'll clean it up for me. Mm-hmm. Usually drops the size about 80% or something. And I copy that and I paste it into my project, whether that's CodePen or whatever. That's kind of my workflow. That's what I do. I got my designers all on that workflow as well. It seems to be working pretty well. As far as the trade-off, like SVGs are just math. It's just a list of points. Computers are really good at math. Like, so I think they can do it, you know. I think that's the, like, you get into images, you have, like, compression and bytecode and, you know, there's algorithms it takes to, like, nearest neighbor to, like, fuzz 2 pixels together if it's, you know, kind of small or there's not enough pixels to render the image. Like, there's a lot of work behind the scenes to, like, put an image on, to paint an image of 3 million pixels onto a page. SVGs are typically just math, you know, they're, that said, you can make a very bad SVG and it'll be really rough. And sometimes from Adobe, they'll like sneak a PNG inside the SVG. We had that on a client site.
Sure. Drop shadows were notorious for that. Right?
Oh man. Surprise. The logo is actually just a PNG. Like we're just like, what? And so you have to really kind of, whatever, you have to kind of be a, I don't want to say Nazi or cop, but you have to really like kind of like look at the SVG, and that's where it might be overwhelming. You have to really look at an SVG and just say like, you like, what's in you? Does it look good? And you need to know the difference between good and bad. And then eventually you'll go to the level where you're like, I'm just going to write this hamburger menu by hand. And like, because you're a jerk and you're just like, you know, I know how to write 3 lines in SVG. So I'm just going to write 3 lines in SVG. Like, it'll be like 8 bytes.
That's probably your best bet to kind of golf it, as they say, if you can. Golf often refers to just removing characters when you can for the sake of smallness, but I often think of it probably incorrectly, but whatever, as like handwriting it because you're going to write less characters than any software is going to do. You know, I heard from a fella at Wikipedia, I think, that was kind of like somehow had taken in charge of dealing with the SVGs for Wikipedia. And, you know, and there's obviously millions of billions of jillions of them, right? So I have a lot of experience at the different tools. And it does matter what the tool does, and it does matter what the optimizer does. And it's not SVG OMG, I think, is a great choice because it uses SVGO under the hood. But there's, you know, I think there's more than two there's either three or four like major optimizer tools. None of them are particularly well maintained anymore. I don't think there's any developers working on any SVG optimization tool, as sad as that is to the world. But they have different approaches. They do different things. They error in different ways, yada, yada. So it's kind of one of those things where if you're really taking this crazy seriously, you should try all the different ones and see what the results you get are as far as like the fidelity and the file size and that type of thing. For example, you know, like SVGO notably can reduce precision if you need it to, you know, like if some, for some reason Adobe software outputs five decimal places and that's way more precise than you'll ever need it to be in the DOM, it can just wank some of those off, which reduces file size and computational speed and stuff. That's neat. But like, you got to be really careful with that, because if you whack precision too far, it's a fidelity thing. You know, if you zoom in too big, it gets weird. And I don't think all of them can do that. And, you know, here's one too. Like, you have a G element in SVG, you know, just an arbitrary group. Well, that can have a transform on it. Have you ever seen this in an SVG where it's like Adobe will be like, I'm going to take this G and transform it 1,000 pixels, you know, to the left.
To the left.
And then, and then for some reason, the path inside just transforms it back to where it was.
Yeah, all the paths inside start at 100, 100, or whatever. Like, they all start, like...
There's no optimizer tool in the world that can suss that out. It's just going to leave it alone. It can't. So that's unfortunate, too. That's one of those things where the tooling then also matters in addition to the optimizer, that, like, the less of that going on, the better, you know?
Well, I was going to say, Brenda Storer has a really good talk called Cracking the SVG Code, where she explains, like, path attributes and stuff like that, and how to make an arc and stuff. This unlocked everything in my brain. Like, I just was like, I understand what's going on and what those letters and numbers mean, and it's not just dark magic to me anymore. So Brenda Storer, really good talk called Cracking the SVG Code. And, you know, Sarah Swaydan's also another one if you just want, like, the full technical low down on SVG, talk to Sarah. So, but yeah, hopefully, good luck. I would say SVG's fast when you can use it. So it's just math.
That's killer. And high five, Brent. I was also at that talk, and it's very good.
I've never heard anyone explain it to me in a way that made sense. And I just was, this was it. It was like, oh, I get it now. I understand.
Yay.
So, all right. Well, we should wrap it up. Thanks, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's what people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. 10 tweets a month. Over at shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire
people like you.
You and Chris, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, real quick, if you were into that dual screen stuff that Dave was talking about, he got a little bloggy about it, and there's two great posts on DaveRupert.com about that.
Oh, yes, I blogged. I'm a blogger.
ShopDocShow.com.
I'm a blogger.
My beard just grew out a little bit here.